This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 8th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 291 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's show, we'll speak to the author Andrew Keane, who'll tell us why, as the digital revolution rolls on, the internet is not the answer.
Also ahead, capturing some of the greatest human rights struggles of our times, we'll meet the curator of Human Rights, Human Wrongs, a new photography show here in London.
And before the end of the programme, we'll meet the bookseller-turned-novelist, Brooke Davies, on how selling books prompted her to write her own.
All that, plus our look ahead at the story sure to set the news agenda in the week ahead, that's all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Would you care for a segment of orange?
You've got orange scarf, you've got orange fruit.
I mean, I know.
You've gone totally orange.
You've gone Naranja.
Someone said that about you a bit earlier as well, I think.
This is a strange smell I'm giving off. I've done that terrible thing, eating on the radio, sorry.
It's right. It's good vitamins. It will get us through the next hour.
It'll get us through the next hour. We don't want to get scurvy here on Monocle 24,
do
we? We've got a lot of output. Are we allowed to tell people about some of the changes that might happen to Monocle 24? It's going to get even better. Are we allowed to tell people about that?
Yeah.
No.
You know what? We come and can say, new season of shows starts March 2. It's more like Monday, March 2, the new season begins. That's better.
Oh, that's a brilliant Marcus Hippie impersonation. Yeah. I don't know if anyone listening to this show also listens to The Menu, hosted by a resident Finn, Marcus Hippie. But he does sound like, and I don't know also if any of our listeners have ever heard the former BBC weatherman Ian McCaskill, but he also sounds a bit like that.
Okay, well, I'm going to take that as an insult. And
sorry.
Shall we talk,
is normally the bit of the show where we get on with each other. That's clearly not happening today. Let's bring in a couple will never have an argument in the company of someone else. So let's bring in the one and only Tom Edwards.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much. It's so many months into that joke, and I'm still laughing at my own joke.
It's because it's at my expense, Andrew, and you're a vindictive character. So there we are.
Until we unleash your promo, your walk-on music, you swaggered into the studio today.
I know,
you're in
I'm
a good
crushed.
Mood. What's going on?
Now I'm just a husk.
It felt like you were walking into a sort of saloon with. It seemed like you were hog-tied.
I like to do that. You know, those saloons with the swing doors.
Yeah.
Walk in there with my cowboy hat low over my eyes.
Yeah.
All goes quiet.
Yeah.
An air of menace.
What do you order? Flirtini.
Just a baby sham.
They don't put those doors anywhere now. They used to be quite popular in the 60s and 70s.
Mm. That's when I remember them from, of course. But yeah, they've phased them out now. It's a crying shame. Bring them back if you're listening, whoever is in charge of swing doors.
Yeah, I like a swing door. Always at home.
The cowboy builder company.
Hey!
It works on two levels.
That's me.
I was going to say something else, but let's just move straight into the news.
Yeah, tell us what's going to happen.
I've got a few sort of artsy bits and bobs, Rob, for you to kick things off. Award season continues. Today, BAFTAs, Britain's kind of low-rent Oscars effort.
They're quite good, aren't they? Come on.
I think they've got better. I think they actually tend to get some of the actual proper players into town. I know Michael Keaton, who I'm a big fan of, is in the mix. He's here this year, so he's jetted over. And then the Grammys is happening stateside, so it's a bit of a kind of an awards bonanza.
It's big, isn't it?
If that's your ticket.
Well, I mean, they're nice.
Is that your ticket?
Nice.
You look singularly unimpressed.
Well, I was just going to say the Grammys are a bit kind of.
I don't think anyone really cares.
No,
I don't really care.
Maybe I shouldn't have even brought that up.
The Grannies now. That would be a good.
That's good.
International Granny Awards. I'd go to that.
Can I nominate my elderly whitehead grandmother Betty?
Really?
She'd be very flattered to get a mention.
My granny was called Betty.
Betty, you're a winner to us, dear.
There you go. How about she won't be listening to this. It'll confuse her. She'll think someone's outside.
Okay. Before we lapse into some others who haven't. Impersonations.
What about the contemporary art sales? Now, I like to mention these when there's something that excites me. Bacon's Two Studies for Self-Portrait. This last sold in the early 90s, Rob, for a snip at 350,000, I think, pounds.
Who's selling this?
Estimate. It's at Sotheby's now. 18 million estimate. Because, wow, of course, he set auction records last year. I think it was $150 million
or
something.
The studies of the George Dyer.
And this is going to be an absolute bonanza. So there's Juan Munoz. You've got Warhol, Yves Klein, Cy Twombly. These big Bacon things are probably going to be the centerpiece of the sales. But this is going to be another mega, mega numbers. That's on Tuesday in London. I've always think that's rather exciting.
And people will do this. Is the bubble ever going to burst in the art market? They'll have this conversation over and over again. Mm.
But that's pretty amazing, isn't it? You're talking only, what is that? Just about 20 years, 300 grand to 18 million. That's a pretty tidy investment if you consider all of the other. Not that, you know, I always think you should only be buying things if you want to put them up in your house or...
Or make 18 million.
I was going to say,
I'm not going to put it up.
If you were buying it to make money, I find something depressing about that notion. It's a good investment, yeah, but...
Andrew wouldn't have it in his house, would you? Would you not? Bacon in your house. He's a vegetarian.
That is good.
Do you know, I thought about sniffing around that joke. I thought, even for me, it's too low.
Leave that to the absolute dunce.
I loved that. I thought it was great. That's my comedy.
Sorry.
Let's look ahead. Let's look ahead to the end of the week. Talking of things that are utterly ridiculous. Are either of you Paris Caver Deca triophobic?
Para,
Scava, Deca, Triophobic. I think it's perfectly clear what I said.
Numbers.
In a sense.
Really?
Very much so, Andrew. But what, more specifically?
Scared of them.
It's the weekly look ahead. Of the week and a number. Put them together.
Friday the 13th.
So that's what's happening.
There's two Friday the 13th in a row.
Exactly. It's quite terrifying. Yeah. Now, I actually think this is nonsense. There's all this kind of religious and semi-religious classical hokum, which is the reason why it's supposed to be a big deal. And that word comes from Paraskevi, which is Friday in Greek, Dekatris, which is 13, and phobia, of course. And then you agglutinate them to make that.
Nice.
I that doesn't really go anywhere after that. But
will you be what will you be doing on what will you not be doing on Friday the 13th?
I will not be afraid.
Operating heavy machinery.
I will not be afraid, Rob. Yeah.
Okay, you're going to be operating the heavy machinery of Monocle 24.
Yeah, after taking prescription medication, just to defy the gods.
You're going
to
use a lathe and everything.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, with a blindfold on. Do that. Yeah. The knife with your fingers thing.
Absolutely. I've got a couple more. Do you want a couple more quickly?
Yeah, we're enjoying this. This is a good week.
World Radio Day is on Friday as well. And I just think anything that celebrates radio as a medium is worth getting behind.
We should make a radio show.
Yeah, what about a whole radio station?
Do loads of radio.
Is that how Monocle 24 began? It probably is.
Okay, we like that.
But all sorts of things. You know, there'll be sort of community radio events, that kind of thing. Grassroots radio, which is great.
Yeah.
Right up to the very, very top draw, like Monocle 24. I think, you know, everyone should mark it.
Yeah, we'll put a banner up.
And then I've got one last thing, Andrew. This is something I've picked.
He's like drawing doodles. He's not even looking at you.
I know, but this will bring him back. This will get Andrew's focus back. Andrew, next Saturday there's an event taking place, which I think will have a special resonance for you.
What is it, like gay dogs and their owners or something?
Have you been looking at my list? No.
Gay dogs and their owners.
This is an event that you've been so excited about this event previously that you actually participated in what I believe is an award-winning interview about it. Let me see if you can remember when we play an extract from this interview of Andrew Tuck in action. Take it away, team.
She's a festival staff member, Patricia Mierzig, and she's joining us on the line now to tell us all about Lemons. Tell me, how come Menon has this festival? Why does Menon have a lemon festival? Oh, they're whispering.
There's a person in my... Okay, so I would like to introduce you with the Lemon Festival in Mentone.
Yes.
It's a very important birthday. It's the 80 years old of the Mentone Lemon Festival.
That was literally the worst interview cringe I have ever done in all of my time on Monocle.
Next weekend,
radio.
It's back. It's the 82nd edition.
Oh, please, can we get you to interview her again?
The Fête du Citron.
Yeah. What was so good was the whole interview, she was turning around to someone in the office going, oh, what does he say? I don't know what he says.
It's literally
I haven't heard that before. My favourite is really awful. It's made me really, I can hardly sit in here.
My favourite interview of Monocle 24 or just of anywhere.
Any media interview.
I'm really hot now. I'm gonna have to take my jumper off. I'm literally perspiring after hearing
that's
that.
That's really bad. So that's excellent. Please can you do it again?
So it's in Menton.
Festival de Radio du Citron.
Menton on the Côte d'Azur.
Andrew can be hosting the whole thing.
The 82nd annual festival starting next Saturday. So, you know, get amongst it.
Menton's a nice part of the world down there as well.
Very, very beautiful. But fans of citrus fruits or just terrible radio, like, get involved.
Just don't do an interview.
Well,
you turned the tables out at the end.
For once, I got a small measure of revenge.
That's very nice indeed. Tom, thank you for a classic news look ahead.
That the internet has changed the world is something few would argue with. But whether it's changed our lives for the better is a question the author Andrew Keane believes he has the answer to.
And that answer is no. In his new book, The Internet is Not the Answer, he argues that the internet has largely been a negative force in our lives today. I'm delighted to say that Andrew Keane joins us now. Andrew, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. The internet is not the answer, but what was the question in the first place?
So the question is what? Should the operating system be for the 21st century? And at the moment, the internet's not working, is it? Simple.
Well, I'd agree with you. Not in this studio.
We should explain that your credentials are not as an outsider in this world. This is something you've been involved in the world of the internet for a long time. You're a critic from within. And what are your main charges about your concerns about the internet?
Well, my main concerns, and you know, we use this word, the internet. I wish I had a better word. Because I'm talking about something big. I'm talking not just about a series of pipes. I'm talking about a profound shift in the way we do business, the way we relate to one another, equivalent in many ways to the Industrial Revolution. So when I talk about the Internet Revolution, digital society, network society, we're talking about more than just technology. So there are three areas in particular that I'm disappointed with in terms of what the Internet or the Digital Revolution has delivered so far. Firstly, it's compounding inequality. We know that Thomas Piketty wrote a very famous book on capital in the 21st century. The internet is not the cause of the increasing chasm between wealth and poverty and power and powerlessness in the world, but it's an important piece now of this equation. Centrally, I think, creating a new class, a new elite of technology workers, a new center to the world, Silicon Valley, and not distributing the wealth and not creating a middle class, contributing indeed to the hollowing out of the old industrial middle class. Secondly, the internet's contributing to our jobless crisis. Technology is eating jobs, eating the old jobs of the industrial age, and not really coming up with replacements. Travis Kalanick of Uber promises Europe 50,000 jobs, but these aren't real jobs. This is a gig economy of semi-employment. So that's deeply worrying. And of course, the spectre of the robot. I'm doing a debate in London in March with Walter Isaacson about the role of robots and whether we should be worried about them. I'm not sure they're imminent in terms of literally taking away our jobs, but intelligent machines and the intelligent network are taking away more and more industrial jobs and not coming up with new jobs. And thirdly, the internet has contributed what I call a surveillance economy, where we supposedly get these great products like Google and Facebook for free, but we've been turned into the product, and their business is watching us, figuring out what we're doing, what we're thinking, where we're going, and selling that data to advertisers. So it's bad enough that the free economy isn't really free, but we're the mugs. We've been sold on lots of levels. And so this economy, in my view, doesn't work. It doesn't have any long-term viability. We need to go back to a more traditional cash economy where we exchange cash for goods rather than this so-called free economy where we're selling our souls, sometimes knowledgeably, sometimes ignorantly, and losing our privacy and losing our rights as human beings.
Why do you think there's that gap between you meet the person who's concerned about how their food is made and where their t-shirt was made, but they then have a phone that perhaps was made in a factory by people who are underpaid. They allow their money to go to corporations that don't pay any tax. And yet they don't seem to, in the end, call them to much accountability. You know, we see the profits of these companies, as you say, they're massive. There can't be that much rejection by the consumer. Why is there this gap? Do you think that we have changed just so much and there's a generation of people, in a way, who don't care?
That's a really interesting question. I think one of the areas that I address in the book, maybe not formally, but I touch on in lots of different ways, is the way in which the internet has been built up around the cult of the consumer. The idea that the internet has been somehow delivered to us by a stork in the middle of the night for our benefit, and we have that right. So we only think of the internet in terms of rights rather than responsibilities. And the consumer, I think, contemporary consumers, think they have a right to free information, think they have a right to radically cut price goods on Amazon. And we're not willing to take responsibility. We're not really willing to understand that we're forming a Faustian bargain. So Amazon's a great service. We all use it. I joke often that it's like pornography. We all use it, but no one will admit it. And the dark side of Amazon are their exploitative labor practices. The dark side is their way in which they're bullying publishers. The dark side of Amazon is the destruction of independent retail. And I think you're absolutely right. The environmental movement or the green movement needs to discover digital, needs to discover technology. And I think the zeitgeist is actually shifting. I think people are beginning, with books like mine and people like Jérôme Lanier, people are beginning to understand that the revolution has failed and it's actually delivering stuff that is offensive and to progressives. I think in political terms, one of the targets in my book are those progressives who said that people like Larry Lessig of Harvard University, who said that the internet would right all the injustices of capitalism, and they're absolutely wrong. But I think your point about, you know, eating organic food and driving Priuses and all the rest of it, it needs to extend to whether or not we use Amazon, whether indeed we use Google. I think data is the new pollution, and I think we're going to see the emergence of digital environmental movements, equivalent to the environmental movements that came up against the pollution of industrialization. I think we may even see entire political parties built around this issue of data.
I wanted to ask you a sociological question, Andrew, which is about I think the internet seems selfish. All the major brands, the social networking sites, they're all about, it's like a solipsistic universe that exists online, which isn't. They make the point in the book that people want the internet to be like the village pub where everybody knows each other's names and a bit of their business, but now everybody knows everybody's names and everybody's business. Is it a selfish place?
Well, it's a selfie place. I don't know about a selfish place. And of course, the social media was promised as being social, but it actually reflects the increasingly atomized, individualized nature of the world. It's both, again, it comes back to the internet as both a cause and a consequence of many of the most distinct and troubling features of post-industrial capitalist society. So we're told that the internet's social. We're told that we should go on these social networks like Facebook. And of course, in a sense, they are social. But in a more profound way, they're not, because we use them to broadcast ourselves. So the Occupy movement, for example, was supposed to be social. We're supposed to bring people together. But if you looked at the Occupy website, it was really just a quilt of individual voices. And no one was able to tie them together, which explains why Occupy fizzled away and didn't mature into a coherent political movement. And of course, the logical conclusion of all this, of this atomization, fragmentation, individualization, is the selfie culture, is our obsession with not only broadcasting ourselves, but photographing ourselves. One of the most, you know, disturbing and symbolic examples of this, as I talk about in the book, is, you know, we go just around the corner. There's the Wallace collection in London. You know, people are going in and looking at the masterpieces and rather than gazing at them and thinking about whatever one is supposed to think about when one looking at masterpieces, one takes a selfie
How much
of oneself.
Cost is the
yeah,
there.
Well, taking a selfie of ourselves in front of the masterpiece and then broadcasting it on the web. And there's lots of other even more tasteless examples of this selfie culture. You know, taking selfies at Auschwitz, and I have lots of examples of like that in the book. So as I argue in the book, we've retreated to back beyond the village to a kind of pre-Copernican universe where we think the world revolves around us. And of course, it doesn't. What we need to do now is remind ourselves not of our significance, but of our insignificance.
A final question. This idea of free. You look at how Spotify is actually kind of, you know, being presented as a kind of solution for the music industry, but in fact pays almost no money to artists. You've looked at how, in the book, how our world, the media world, you have these supposed champions like The Guardian, but they're losing money hand over fist. You know, what's happened with this notion of, you know, free to especially the worlds of music and media?
As I argue in the book, free has failed. We were told in the 90s that you could give your stuff away online and that some business model would miraculously emerge, and it hasn't. And what we've seen is the decimation of the music business. Global sales in recorded music have been cut in half since 1999. That's partly due to piracy. It's also partly due to the fact that when you give stuff away online, in the end, no one buys it. Now, you guys at Monocle are fighting that. You have a very nice product which you sell. And newspapers have come around to that too, that they understand that to build an online business in a viable way, you have to have a paywall. But the problem was, is at the beginning in the 90s, for the first 15 years of the web's history since its creation in 1989, we were under the illusion that we could give the stuff out for free. And there's no nobility in free information. There's no nobility in free content. People like John Perry Barlow, one of the early evangelists of the web, said that information wants to be free. And there's this idea that somehow it's unjust to sell content online, that you should be giving it away. But tell a starving musician that. Tell an impoverished writer or a photographer. And one of the greatest tragedy, I think, so far of the internet is that with all this new wealth, with all this remarkable new media, and it is remarkable, we've had a deep crisis of the creative class. Scott Tinberg of the Los Angeles Times has written a book called The Crisis of the Creative Class. I touch on it a lot in my book as well. It's a terrible time now to be a professional writer, professional musician, professional filmmaker. Now, there are opportunities. You can always win the lottery on YouTube. But what we're seeing in terms of this new inequality and the disappearance of the middle class is you're seeing exactly the same trends in entertainment and information. And it's fine if you're at the high end. It's fine if you're a Malcolm Gladwell or an Arianna Huffington or an Andrew Sullivan and you've got a dominant brand. But for the creative person just starting up who wants to earn a living, who wants to be able to live off their creativity, the internet age has been a catastrophe.
Well, Andrew Keane, thank you very much. The book is The Internet is Not the Answer. And it's brilliant. Thank you very much for your time. Should we have some new music, Andrew?
Yes, please.
Not everything's silly.
No, let's have some new music.
Well, it's new music by an old geezer. In fact, it's old music by an old geezer, but it's from a new record. It's the new Bob Dylan album that came out this week. And he's done an American songbook, an American standards album from it, which is a challenge for Bob Dylan, because he famously is a bit crackly, a bit crunkly, a little bit sat on.
And these are new.
This is Rodgers and Hammerstein, Cole Porter.
Yeah, but when did you record it? Now, so
it came out this
week.
Okay,
good.
I'm not just fobbing. I'm not saying, oh, I found this at home.
I thought it was something like in the 1960s or something.
1960s or something.
When I was going down Carnaby Street.
I wish we could just play the theme tune from Austin Powers. We're not going to have that. This is from Bob Dylan's new record, Shadows in the Night. Here's his take on Some Enchanted Evening.
Some Enchanted Evening.
Some Enchanted Evening, new or old, from Bob Dylan, from that wonderful new record called Shadows in the Night.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our bureau chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York bureau chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
Chronicling injustice has long been a preoccupation in contemporary photojournalism. Well, a new exhibition here in London has brought together some of the most compelling examples of photography that captured in some way some of the greatest human rights struggles of our times.
Taking the 1948 Declaration of Human Rights as its cue, the exhibition, Human Rights, Human Wrongs, assesses how that struggle has evolved and how the methods of documenting it have changed too. Well, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now by Mark Seeley, curator of the exhibition at London's Photographers' Gallery.
Mark, before we dive in and start looking at some of the images and explaining more about the show, could you explain to us how you came to curate this?
Well, part of my research, I mean, I'm obviously someone who's interested in rights, race and representation. I mean, you can't be in photography and not think about those very pertinent questions. And the whole idea of universal declarations, for example, rights of man and other ideas about how we're all supposed to get along in the world are kind of key to the curatorial underpinning, if you like, of the research behind this show. So after doing a show on Santu Mufeking's work, who was an apartheid era photographer, I was invited via Ryerson to think about their collection and the Black Star collection, which was an incredible opportunity. 1935, it's one of the first agencies in the world. It spans an incredible amount of time. And of course, the opportunity to look at history in that space meant that we could begin to think about curating it and underpinning it through some ideological things like rights.
Now, one of the things that the exhibition about is about Article 6. This is a reference point for it.
Yes.
And again, for listeners who may not be fully aware of what Article 6 means, explain that to us.
Well, Article 6 is the right to representation. Now, of course, in 1948, when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is announced to the world, I think they're looking at this through the prism of a legal framework, the right to representation, probably mainly in the court. What I've done with this is I've thought about this in relation to photography and representation, who sees who, by who, and where and when. And obviously most of the world events in terms of the media have been produced by Western agencies, either Life magazine, Picture Post, BBC, other kind of, you know, media-related organizations. So this right to representation, if we think about it from the perspective of difference or otherness, is one that hasn't been brought into the frame, certainly not in this era or the latter part of the 20th century anyway.
So is your feeling that the person who was holding onto the camera back in the 50s and 60s who was shooting the images was often seeing protesters or seeing others rather than being part of that movement, for example?
I think that's not wholly true. I do think some of the civil rights photographers, for example, were wholly embedded in the idea of trying to represent that space. But I do think we have to recognise that there is a point of view. That a lot of the Black Star images, for example, were made for the press. They were made to, fill pages, double page spreads and covers, and they were made with the point of view of an editor in mind. So if there's going to be a conversation about what's relevant, it's not going to be from those who are on the other side of the frame, for example. It's going to be how that's mediated within that life spread or time spread or another spread.
Now, you had the opportunity to sift and decide and determine what would produce what in the end is always, it's always a complicated thing for a curator. You're pulling out a very small number of images to try and tell a bigger story.
Yeah.
What was your selection process?
I'm very interested in how violence works and what we see and how we respond to violence and who's in the frame. So, for example, there are some kind of iconic moments from, say, again, the civil rights movement and other historical eras like the apartheid movement. But what I wanted to do is to expand the frame. I wanted to expand the frame so that people could realize that 1963 is important, not just because of, say, Martin Luther King's speeches, but also because of things like the Organization of African Unity, Haile Selassie, Ethiopia, Addis, when 50-odd, world leaders come together and decide what might be the future of kind of a pan-African ideological space or a political space. So the point of the show is to open up those reference points, is to show the interconnected nature of those moments, and to also encourage people to think about not just the local moments, i.e. a march down Alabama or a Soweto uprising, but to think about it through the prism of, say, something like the Cold War, where all of these moments are kind of framed in a much wider ideological kind of contested space.
Now, you say the collection that you were choosing from ran from the 30s onwards. The images that that we've been given as press images, they're from a quite a succinct period from 62, 63 to around about 68. And we'll talk about some of these now, but then, you know, there's images from Czechoslovakia and from Biafra and from Cuba. But it was that a deliberate thing that there was a, that you were looking what was happening in different places almost at the same time?
Yeah, and I think what tends to happen is, as I said, I think people think about Cuba in isolation. People think about the civil rights in isolation. We know that, for example, people like, you know, Malcolm X were talking to African independence leaders, for example. So I'm trying to widen the debate. I'm trying to show people that there is an interconnectivity across these political spaces, that you can't talk about, you know, the civil rights movement without talking about apartheid. You can't talk about the Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 without understanding that in 1948 apartheid starts. So it's all about those contradictions. And that's why I think kind of extracting Article 6 as the right to representation almost exposes some of the fault lines in these kind of post-World War II ideological democratic moments where, after the disasters of World War II, we were all supposed to be in a better place. I think what this show clearly illustrates is that there's been nothing, if you like, other than a kind of continuous war. Nothing has really changed. It's just that it's, and it's been global, but it's not been looked at through the prism of a world war as such. And especially aimed at kind of young people who might be, who might see something like 68 as such a far moment away. But for most of us, including myself, it is living memory.
Now, let's look at one or two of the images. So, for example, there is perhaps an image that feels almost like a classic image now of Birmingham, Alabama. Yeah. These images, you know, we've seen depicted in film. We've seen, you know, the stories told in many, in many instances. How do you choose a picture from that time that still feels fresh and that still connects with us?
I think this moment in terms of making photographs was such a visual space. I mean, it's so appealing. I mean, when we look, the reason why I've chose this particular photograph, which has a young woman pointing very directly at a police officer holding a baton, is that I want to show that, you know, young people in that time acted. They were on the front line. They were engaged. They weren't, you know, thinking about it through the prism of, say, something like Facebook. They weren't just talking to each other, that they were facing down the physical reality of meeting the thing that was holding them back. And I think we forget that, you know, and I think we forget, we imagine that the civil rights is, you know, guys in black suits, white shirts and black ties singing "We Will Overcome." But it was an incredible active space. And it wasn't just about names and heroes, but it was about a people on the move. And to counteract those kinds of images of black people, you know, fighting for their rights, I've counteracted, in the exhibition, you will see a lot of photographs of white people waiting. The reason why they're in the show is because it's really important to imagine yourself as a white person in the South. You've been brought up on the idea that you are a superior race, that you're not supposed to mix with these black people. So what's changing? The frightening aspect of everything you understand about yourself as a person, even as a racist, is being kind of contested.
It's interesting who becomes the radical in these pictures. There's another image, which is from Czechoslovakia, and this is when Russian troops, Soviet troops, came into Prague, taken August 21st, 1968. And the woman shouting here is what I would guess would be a pensioner. She's the front line. She's the protester.
Correct.
Again, it's interesting that galvanizing. Who goes out and fights for things?
I think this is absolutely correct. I mean, you know, when things impacted on us in this time, I mean, I think it was very important that people felt as though that they could act. And of course, we still do see that. Egypt recently is an incredible example of kind of people power, if you like. But it's about locating that activity in time. I mean, 68 is, yes, it's about Prague. These press photographs are from Prague and some of them are from Paris, etc. But 68 was also Tokyo. 68 was also Mexico. 68 was also campuses across the United States. There was a certain sense of interconnected kind of political activity in these moments. And the Cold War was a real threat. I mean, the idea of being nuked for my generation, born in 1960, was something that you kind of lived with. The idea of living in a state with terror around the corner, I mean, you know, we had the IRA, bombs were going off almost every year, disasters were occurring. So we grew up in this space, and the show really invites people to look back in that space and also to think about it in terms of their rights now.
I also like the fact that although this the exhibition has a quite gritty title, Human Rights, Human Wrongs, there's quite a bit of wit in here as well. There's a really wonderful, wonderful photo which was taken in the Republic of Congo. This is 1960, and the King of Belgium has gone there, and he's standing in an open-topped car, and someone has pinched his sword.
That is probably one of the defining moments of kind of post-colonial Africa. The idea that, you know, someone runs alongside the car and steals the ceremonial sword of King Baudouin while Kazavubu, the elected, newly elected president, is facing down Avenue Boulevard, Prince Albert Boulevard. And, you know, it's almost as if it's like a Fanonian, Franz Fanonian moment, like the wretched of the earth stealing power on the day. I mean, it's a deeply disturbing photograph as well, but it is kind of abstracted kind of moment where he grabs this thing. I wonder, when I look at this photograph, the psychology of the man in that space. What on earth was going on when he grabs that saber is what I imagine. It's like an opportune, irresistible grab. Then he runs down. Later, you'll see in the sequence when you go to the exhibition that he does get arrested. He gets thrown into the back of a Jeep. And apparently, later that day, he was simply released. But it was one of many insults that King Baudouin would face as he gives back the Congo to its people.
The young man looks totally jubilant in the picture, which is wonderful. I just wanted to ask you a slightly difficult question, but what's fascinating is, you know, we're talking here about a time when the world was polarized. There were difficult things going on in every corner of the world. We then had this amazing period of history where, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it felt that everybody was being nice to everybody, and, you know, there was a, even though all the parties were middle of the road. But now we've gone back to a time of, you know, extreme difficulties around the world. You know, there are people out there documenting everything that's going on. Tough images coming up on the fronts of our newspapers. A terrible image of a guy being burnt in a cage this week, a Jordanian pilot. Do you feel that the role of these photographers and the need to get out on the streets and things, it's, this show comes at a very pertinent time?
I think a show like this is always going to be pertinent. And I would maybe disagree with you that, you know, just because the Berlin Wall fell down, that they were, you know, optimistic times. I think what happened is that there was a certain sense of victory, if you like, on this side of the wall, that there'd been, that capitalism had done and run its course. And the other side, the colder side, was had thawed effectively. And I think all that really shifted is that capitalism began to do its work. So I think the question of human rights is always going to be relevant. I think the question of how we take responsibility for those rights as citizens is always going to be pertinent. And I think the very idea of how one and how a state acts across its citizens, how the state responds to you as an individual, will always be in the frame.
Well, the exhibition opens this week in London. It's called Human Rights, Human Wrongs. And Mark, how many images roughly?
There's approximately 300 images in the show.
Mark Seeley, curator of the new exhibition Human Rights, Human Wrongs, thank you very much for joining us. And that exhibition runs at the Photographer's Gallery here in London until the 6th of April.
Up next here on the Monocle Weekly, we'll meet the bookseller turned novelist Brooke Davis. Do stay tuned.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Millie Bird is 7 years old, and one day, while on a shopping trip with her mum in a department store, she goes missing. The search for her draws in the unlikely characters of two octogenarians who, thanks to their own experiences of loss and love, find much in common with the little girl's unexpected journey.
So begins Lost and Found, the debut novel by the Australian bookseller turned author Brooke Davis. And I'm delighted to say that Brooke joins us in the studio. Now, before we start asking you about your book, so you've jumped from the one side of the counter to the other. You started off actually selling books. Did that help with the writing of this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still selling books, actually. I'm still a bookseller because, unfortunately, when you publish a book, you don't become a millionaire, which was a surprise. It's been really fun selling my own book, actually.
So in your shop now, that's what people get offered, is it, when they come in?
They're not allowed to leave until they buy a coffee.
But did it kind of, had it given you a bit of experience seeing the kinds of things that people like, who your audience might be? Did it give you some inkling of how, you know, when you actually sat down with, we don't have paper in front of us anymore, when you, with a laptop in front of you, what you might start writing?
Yeah, I mean, it gave me an insight into the stuff that happens after you write it, you know, and to do with titles. I wanted a strong and simple title because I know how people come up to the counter and they say, oh, there's this book, it's got like a kid's name in the title, it's green. And so I wanted something really strong that that people would remember. Other than that, I didn't really even think about it getting published, to be honest, because I think that's what the experience of book selling has always given me, that the industry is difficult, and it probably kept my expectations really, really low, which was good.
A good place to start.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, I often ask this of songwriters and artists as well, whether when they're writing, whether they should read at the same time, or whether those thoughts pollute or inspire the stuff that they're working on. What about for you? I mean, I get you can't escape books in your day job, but for your evenings and weekends job, is it a blessing or a curse to be selling books?
I think that's a really good question. I think everyone's really, really different. But for me, I always need the kind of jumping off of someone else's work, just because it gets my brain kind of agile, you know, it gets it kind of working and the cogs kind of spinning. But I totally understand why you wouldn't, because it could definitely, and I can actually see that when sometimes I look at some of the passages I've written, I've known what I've been reading.
But lots of people do that, aren't they? Some novelists are famous for reading all morning and writing in the afternoon, or the other way around. And that's the idea of, I guess, that's that thing of being inspired by whether it's the rhythm or simply the kind of structure of reading other stuff. Because it doesn't have to be the characters or the vibe. It can just simply be the act of knowing someone else got up at 5 a.m. and put pen to paper that helps you to do it.
Yeah, to feel like you're part of a collective experience is really, really nice, I think, is important.
This book, you know, although it's told about a very young child, it's about the sense of loss for us all. It's about adult loss as well. And that had a very real start for you, the loss of your mum. Again, was there something in that that you found unfolding on the page? Did you know that you wanted to write about the loss of your mum in a less direct way?
Definitely. I actually wrote this book as part of a PhD on the concept of grief. And so that's where the book began for me. I was looking for a way to grieve appropriately, I think. I was really struggling when my mum died. I was really struggling with those kind of buzzwords that we have that float around those concepts of closure and moving on. And I wanted a way to not move on and to not have closure. I wasn't ready for anything like that. And so to have that permission, kind of an academic permission, to sit down and think about my mum and think about what it meant to grieve and work out how I was going to survive without her, I think it was just a blessing to be able to have that. As kids, if we're lucky, we don't actually think it's ever going to happen, really. We don't realise if our parents are good to us, we don't think they'll ever leave us, you know. We think they're kind of infallible. And And it is a shock. I was 27 years old when my mum died, and that's you know, I've had time to get to know her as a human, not just as my mum. But it's still a shock. It's still not the narrative that we're sold. We believe our life is supposed to follow a linear trajectory, and when it doesn't, when it kind of blips out of that, it's definitely a shock. And it can work out in creative ways, you know. I wrote a book because of it, but it was a very, very difficult time, and it's still something that I find difficult.
And you mentioned the idea of closure, which I hope that this novel has given you. But there's an idea. I wonder whether now we're talking about openings and closings and stuff. I wonder whether you ever know when a book is finished, especially someone that obviously, I presume, reads manuscripts before they turn up on your bookshelves as well. When you know that something is, you've nailed that paragraph, that sentence, that thought has run its course.
The awesome thing about getting a book published is that you're contractually...
You've got a deadline.
Yeah, and right. You're contractually obliged to not touch it ever again, which is so nice, because
you could keep on and on.
And it's this beautiful metaphor, actual analogy for that concept of closure, is that it never kind of really comes to an end. When I sometimes do readings, I start circling things because I'm like, oh, I should change that for the next edition.
Yeah.
And you just need to just let it alone.
Now, the other extraordinary thing about the story is that stretch of age and of responsibility and of loss as well, to the other end, the other characters who inhabit this, they're almost like wonderful characters from an Armistead Maupin Tales of the City kind of world. There's Carl and there's Agatha Panther who pop up to take this child on this kind of journey. How important was it to have, that reflection from the other end of the age spectrum?
I think it was great because they were both great positions to question the way things are, because kids are in this beautiful space of pre-self-awareness, a pre-social awareness, and then the elderly, by kind of default, have a similar kind of invisibility, a similar kind of invisible position, which is something that upsets me, that I think is kind of upside down. But it's great from a writing point of view. I was definitely looking for those positions where, or those voices where I felt like I could really interrogate how we deal with grief and death, and ask those really thorny questions that we find difficult to ask ourselves. And I mean, that beautiful position of coming to the end of your life, you can pretty much do whatever you like, and you kind of should be able to, that's what I'm going to be doing.
And it's one of those things, how easy is it? How was it always the case that there would be these fun, that it would be funny too, that it might be, it's a book about grief, but it's clearly got its comic moments. There's a ridiculousness to certain of these situations, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny. It's not, I didn't plan any of that, but it seemed to make sense to me as I was writing it, because, I mean, I guess grief isn't only about the concept of sadness. If you're feeling grief an intense grief for the loss of someone, it's like a reflection of the love you felt with someone, the joy you felt with them. And I wanted that feeling in the book as well. I didn't want to say that grief had a beginning and an end and was only about sadness. It was something that we have to work at how to absorb into our life, in amongst everything else there is.
I was going to say one last thing, but it might not be one last thing. Andrew's chomping at the bit as well.
You take it away.
I wondered whether, to go back to Andrew's first question and your book selling, your job as a bookseller as well, whether we talked about, a punchy title for your novel. What about the cover? Because so many books are displayed, you walk into the bookshop, you've got the table, and you're like, this is the first thing you look at. You can't help, especially if you're buying a gift. These are the things. Does that all factor into it as well? I mean, not wanting to be glib about the contents of your book, which we've explored, obviously are very touching. But what about the mechanics of getting the thing off the shelves and into people's shopping bags?
Yeah, it was an amazing process for me to go through, because it's not something I knew how it worked. I knew how it worked from the sales point of view, but to
you didn't feel like putting a cat gif on the front cover.
Well, now that you mention it.
Oh, there you go. Well, it's out in paperback.
I'll mention that to my publisher. Yeah. But it was, it's incredible because the first question that anyone ever asked me after I told them I was getting it published was, what is the cover going to look like? And so it's obviously very, very important. And I wish I could take any credit for the thinking around it, but all I did was basically just said, yes, please, that looks really good. And I think they did a beautiful job with it.
Perfect. Well, Brooke Davis, thank you very much for joining us. The novel is called Lost and Found. It's out now, published by Hutchinson. Doesn't have a cat gif on the front cover, but as it may be in paperback. Brooke, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I think we got on better throughout as the show went on, Andrew, after our start.
It warmed up. Tom Edwards was very good this week.
He was very good.
He got us in the mood. He was quite entertaining.
He did a bite a bit on you, didn't he?
Yes.
With that wonderful thing. Apparently, I think that, I mean, you know, Private Eye magazine, it comes out every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, they print the same photograph of what's his name?
Of
Andrew Neil,
yeah,
with his arm around a young employee,
and him in a vest,
with a young friend of his, and I wonder whether we should incorporate that into the Monocle Weekly and just constantly replay the Lemon interview.
I don't know what was. It literally was one of those terrible moments when you're on a news show and you just got to keep plugging away, and the poor woman was like turning around every time because she didn't know what I was saying. Anyway,
we do a thing, not wanting to give the game away, but we do a thing where we do, our producers and researchers do pre-interviews, don't they, with a lot of facts, especially on the news shows, to make sure that people are good at talking about the subject that they've been booked to talk about. I think that one might have fallen off the radar. Basic knowledge of English, no. Do you know anything about lemons? No. Do you know anything? Are you from Monton? Never heard of it. Put him on the radio live with Andrew or her. Nice one. Well, we struggled through it. We didn't struggle through it. Skipped gaily through the meadow of the 291st edition of the Monocle Weekly, don't you think?
Yes, and Andrew Keane was fascinating, a great, great speaker. And then, of course, Brooke Davis, we enjoyed her book. And the photography exhibition, I'm going to go and see it.
Nice book.
Nice.
Oh, let's stop. Let's thank our mates behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. And the Monocle Weekly will be back, of course, same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.